Getting a kid to sing a silly song is a pretty easy thing to do. Getting an adult to sing a silly song is a bit more of a challenge. On this edition of Conversations, we meet a man who does that regularly and then brings up the most solemn subjects and gets people to listen and laugh and learn. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. My guest is Dr. Peter Alsop. He is a psychologist, an educator, a songwriter, and he's a singer of very silly songs. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
This may be the most obvious question going, but why is it that silly songs, and I say that with the utmost of respect, access some of the most locked-in places? Why does music break down barriers so that we can think about hard things?
Well, I think there's really two questions here. One is about music, and the other one's about humor. I think that a lot of times, to laugh, we need to feel safe to do some of the kinds of laughter, particularly things that it makes you feel more relaxed, certainly, when you laugh. What I teach about, really, is about emotions. I've had to learn lots myself because I came from a place where we weren't allowed to get sad. You know, I mean, it wasn't something where parents are bad people that say, don't be sad, but we all get that message, be a big girl, don't cry, you know, and kind of subtly as you're growing up. Being angry wasn't okay in my family. Got angry. My dad got much angrier than we did faster. So being scared. Come on, no, be a man. Don't be scared. You know, you can do that. So we grew up with all of that, and I wasn't in touch with a lot of those feelings. So I've had to learn some vocabulary in those things. Music accesses those kinds of things. Sometimes it puts you into a place where you can kind of go, I'm feeling, you know, you ever hear a strain or something or you're in a movie and the music comes up and you're going, God, I'm going to cry. Uh-oh, you know. And some people go to movies so they can cry there. Music accesses the left and right brain at the same time, I think, where we can have information and feelings integrated more. And so I found that wonderfully important for the kind of work I do, which is basically I'm a psychologist, and by playing songs that have humor and music at the same time, people can feel safe enough to kind of say, this is funny, you know, he's making me laugh, so I guess he's okay. I guess I do some of that. Well, they'll consider things. Besides the third in those triumvirate, besides the music and the humor, I put playfulness. Mm-hmm. Because we learn school is no place to play around. We have to be serious. And I think it's a great place to play around. If you can be playful and you're not sure what's going to happen, you're in a place where you're more creative and where something might come up that might be a feeling or something, and you have a chance to talk about it and process some stuff and find out about yourself, which is why I think we're on the planet. Find out who we are and how we interact, how to love people. And so often we're not allowed to be playful, or when people say this is serious, now that you're a grown-up, you have to you have to have a reason for everything you do. It can really shut people down in some ways that I think we can see in the culture are not healthy ways. Adults are not anywhere near as healthy as kids in their behaviors and their activities. So I try to encourage folks to get back in touch with that stuff.
I'm real curious about this. How did you get here from there? So many of us lived in the kinds of families you describe, where you had to grow up quickly, and there wasn't much room for playfulness or humor or spontaneity. Where did Peter Alsop take a left turn or a right turn, probably more logically, that that lets you do this for us, to us, and with us?
I don't know if I have an answer to that question. It wasn't certainly anything I planned. It was sort of, I took the playful child with me. In our family, we laughed a lot, but a lot of times it was at someone's expense. We were teasing all the time, but everybody teased everyone else, so it was sort of fair game. And the first one at the dinner table that could make a joke about somebody else was everyone would laugh, and you kind of get some approval. So there was a lot of humor and laughing, although it was ridicule-based, and so it didn't feel safe. So what you do is you develop a way of operating where you have your defenses nice and high, and you just look over the top enough to be able to say something that's funny, make everybody laugh, and kind of duck back down again, so you're not vulnerable. And so I would do a lot of things that, as I grew up, and as I started, some of my earlier songs were pretty, they were very funny, a lot of clever word games and things that didn't have feelings connected to them that people would laugh and say, this is ridiculous, you know, and what a silly idea, you know. And where I started making some turns were as I got older and I had partners. My first girlfriend was a feminist woman who started getting me to read some. She said, "Do you ever notice how men never read women authors?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "I think they're just afraid." I said, "Give me that book." You know, reading, you know, Doris Lessing. I'm going, "Wow, run away and join a women's commune after I was done reading the book. You know, I was going, boy, this stuff just seems that it touched me. And having kids does it too. You can't maintain your same old ways of operating sometimes when kids are right in your face with their feelings all the time. And if you're going to relate to them in some kind of loving way, you need to sort of examine your own behavior. So both of those things have been real blessings in my life.
This is Peter Alsop, our guest on this edition of Conversations. We'll be talking about what he talks about, which is parenting and left brain, right brain thinking and problems we have getting along and ways that we can get along better. This is Conversations. You know, I want you to sing for us. People who are listening only can't see that you've got your guitar in hand. But at some point, if a song comes to mind, will you just say you want to do that?
Sure.
Good. All right.
Sure.
Is it something about our culture that shuts us down, makes it more difficult for adults to find their own child, to relate to children, to laugh and be easy, for children to grow up in a complicated world? Or is this just universal? You must have a thought about this.
I do have a thought about this. Yeah, I think it's real human behavior, common worldwide, that if there's something painful going on for us, that we want to get away from it. We want to avoid painful stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't that make sense? Mm-hmm. Makes sense to me. And I think that there's some feelings that are quite painful. Being sad is painful. Doesn't feel good. Being angry is painful. You don't like it. You're upset. Or being scared. You know. So when we get into those places and we get messages and support, see, because feelings are contagious, our parents, and not just in our culture, but I think in other countries too, parents don't like to see their kids being sad. Because of what it, guess what it does? Feelings are contagious. It brings up the sadness in the parents. Oh, I don't want to feel... And if the parents don't have the tools to deal with their own sadness, a lot of times they won't allow the kids to be sad. Come on, cheer up. Let's go get something to eat. Everything's going to be fine. You know, if the parents have dealt with some of their own stuff and realized that part of our being alive means that I'm going to be sad sometimes, I'm going to cry, I'm going to be happy sometimes, I'm going to be scared sometimes, and it's okay for other people to see that because that's part of my humanness, then when the child's sad, the parent can come over and say, yeah, I see you're sad. You know, I know what that feels like, you know. It's okay if you cry. Want me to sit here with you for a while? Or if you want, you can be by yourself, and I'll be right in the other room. Just call me if you need me, you know. Isn't that affirming? And wouldn't it have been wonderful for some of us to have that kind of opportunity? Because then you learn about your own sadness. You learn you can cry, and you come through the other side, and you feel better sometimes. Or sometimes you're sad for a while. See, they're called emotions because they mean that they're giving us information about maybe making a change. Something that doesn't feel good, we need to feel it and then say, I need to do something about this because it doesn't feel good. But if we don't feel it, if we stuff it down or medicate it somehow or other, then we keep doing the same thing over and over again because we're not getting the message. Mm-hmm. You know. And a lot of times kids don't get listened to by parents. You know. I've got a song. Would you like to hear one?
I'd like to hear a song.
This is not one of my humorous ones, but this is one of the... I kind of have found that by using playfulness and humor, I started off playing in the streets in New York and getting people to throw money in my guitar case. And when I played anything that was, you know, one of I'd just fallen in love with someone and I wrote a heartfelt love song I'd been working on for 2 weeks, and people just kept walking right by me, you know, and ignoring me. But when I do something silly, they'd stop and throw money in my guitar case and interact with them. So I learned how to perform that way. So I realized that when I do humor, I can really connect with people, and then I have a chance to do some of the songs about feelings that I think are important for us to look at, things I found useful and helpful. And this is one of them. It goes like this. When you tell me you are scared, I will listen 'cause I care. I remember being scared too, so when you tell me, I believe you. When you're angry or you're sad, even if you're feeling bad, I remember feeling bad too, so when you tell me, I believe you. Maybe I can help you with an idea. Maybe I know something that'll make things clear. Or maybe I won't know what to do, but I can be a safe place and I believe you. When I was a kid I cried, had a secret deep inside, but the grown-ups could not see. I thought that something must be wrong with me. So when you tell me you are scared. I will listen cause I care. I remember being scared too. So when you tell me, I believe you. When you tell me, I believe you. When you tell me, I believe you.
Peter Alsop has 12 record albums to his credit, unless there's another one I don't know
that's
about.
That's it so far.
There's 12. The five he calls family albums rather than albums for kids, family albums, which is an important distinction, I think, are all award winners. They've either won a Parents' Choice Award or what's called an indie. Now, an indie is from... Oh, I lost this.
It's the National Association of Independent Record Distributors and Manufacturers. It's like the Grammys, except it's for independent labels.
Oh, good, because I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
All right. So indies, four albums, starting as early as 1983, an album called What Do You Want to Do by Peter Alsop, won the Indie Best Children's Album. Staying Over, another one came out in 1987, won an award not only for the Indie, but the Parents' Choice Honors and the Music for Little People Award. Plugging Away, a very recent album, 1991, that's your most recent, right,
mm-hmm.
is an indie winner. In the Hospital from 1989, a Parents' Choice and Best Children's Album. And Take Me With You from 1986 is a Parents' Choice album. Peter Alsop brought out some adult albums, I guess you could call that, in the 80s, and has since then been making children's and family albums with great success. Singer, songwriter, and psychologist. Peter Alsop, when did you start putting children, parenting, music, and psychology together? Because this feels like a mesh that must have come out of several places.
Well, when I mentioned the feminist woman I was living with who was opening my eyes to a lot of women's issues that I hadn't even considered, you know, I'd go into a room and there'd be three guys and three women, and the guys would all be talking and the women would kind of be doing these eye things, you know. And I knew that there was something was going on and I wasn't catching it. And I sort of wanted to, you know what was happening. So I started really, it was important for me to pay attention and listen and learn. And as I started taking a look at, as I said, reading some materials and finding out, my girlfriend at that time said, we were living in New York, she said, you know, I said, all right, come on, you're a feminist. It's time for you to go down and get the paper. I go down and get the paper. It's your turn. She goes, well, it's abusive for me to go down there. I said, what are you talking about? We walk down there all the time. She said, look, I'll go, but you follow me 50 yards behind me. And I said, okay. So she went down, and all of the whole landscape changed dramatically, watching how the guys were ogling her. She didn't have, like, any provocative clothing on or anything. They just were, like, just looking at her, and the flower guy who we always waved to in the corner was making these lewd sounds with his mouth, and going, wow, this is awful, you know? And I never realized that, you know? I mean, no one ever made rude sounds with their mouth at me. I hadn't had this experience myself. And, you know, so I go, well, this is really abusive. I can see why people are upset, why women are upset about this. And so I started looking into some of the statistics about rape. It was a rape every 9 minutes in the country. And that was 20 years ago. I think it's a little bit more frequently than that now. I don't think that's improved. You know, one out of three young women sexually abused in this country by the time they're 18. You know, one out of five little boys, too. But there's a lot of stuff that goes on that is just, you know, I guess women used to make 59 cents for every dollar that a man would make, and I think it's now up to 63 cents, you know, but it's not, I mean, this is 20, 25 years ago I'm talking about, that way I was looking at some of this stuff. And as I started opening up my eyes to the plight of other kinds of groups of people than the group that I'm in, which is sort of white, male, heterosexual, we have privileges in the culture that it's very hard for us to understand that other people don't have, you know, able-bodied. And as I started looking at some of the world through these other eyes, I started going, whoa, this doesn't seem right. And maybe I can write some songs about it so we can talk about it. And what happened as I was doing this, you know, incest and child abuse and things that happened too, not just to women, but was another area of a group of people that didn't have advocacy and didn't have a voice about some of the things that we needed to look at. And as I started doing more and more things around child abuse issues, people were getting really excited about my material and saying, this is wonderful, we need to talk about this, and can we use your song? And there's one that's here, you want to do another song?
Mm-hmm.
This is one that I'm real proud of. It's been used in self-protection programs for kids all over this country and in Canada and Australia and Great Britain. It's called My Body's Nobody's Body But Mine. My body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run mine. We didn't want to lurch into the heavy stuff right away. We kind of started off easy, you know. My nose was made to sniff and to sneeze. I chew to smell what I want and to pick when I please. Come on. My body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run mine. You said there's some listeners that are listening on the radio? Well, they can sing along, can't they, if they want? Okay, at home. Even the people on television, I guess. My mouth was made to blow up a balloon. I can eat, kiss, and spit. I can whistle a tune. Let's whistle one all together. Come on out there. All right, Susan. Yeah. No one knows my body better than me. It tells me, let's eat. It tells me, go pee. So don't hit me, don't kick me, don't push or shove. Don't hug me too hard when you show me your love. 'Cause my body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run mine. Well, sometimes it's hard to say no and be strong. But when those no feelings come, then I know something's wrong. Because my body's mine, from my head to my toe. So please leave it alone when you hear me say. You yelling out there in radio land? No, come on all together. My body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run my last time. My body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run mine.
And the crowd roared. Peter Alsop. It's a wonderful song. It's positive and fun, and it's a toe-tapper and makes you want to sing. And it just rolls right into one of the issues that we least talk about in this culture. Mm-hmm.
And for me also, there's neat things about it. I mean, I like the first verse about picking your nose, mm-hmm. because it's also about being able to do other things. And I've had actually teachers, I mean, a lot of people use this, but I've had a couple of letters where teachers said, well, I can't use that verse because it might tell the children it's all right to pick their nose, you know. And I'm going like, I mean.
Like it's their nose.
Well, oh, exactly. It's their nose. And the other thing is, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, 30 little kids all picking their nose at the same point just because they had permission from this song. And even if they did. What an opportunity for the teacher to say, okay, hold it, you know, I know those are your noses, and you can pick them when you want, but, you know, I don't like to watch you pick your nose. Here's some other things, here's some other options. You can put a Kleenex up when you're going to do it, you can go in the other room and do it, you can go to the bathroom, pick and blow your nose. I don't enjoy watching, and I think you need to have that information, you know, and here's some other options of ways you can do it if you're going to be considerate of people. What an opportunity to do some teaching instead of doing censorship. Does that make sense?
Makes huge sense.
Yeah. So, but it's also kids love it because if I do stuff at all, I mention boogers, they'll listen to anything else I got to say for the rest of the concert, kind of, because I'm identifying myself with someone who's not going to be uptight and restrictive and who's willing to be playful with them, mm-hmm. which is sometimes doesn't happen with adults, you know, because we're taught they're supposed to be serious. Robert Fulghum talks about how kids in kindergarten will get up and dance and sing, and then you say, you want to dance? Sure, we'll just dance. What do you want? What dance do you want to do? We don't care. We just want to dance, you know. But by the time you move up into fifth grade or sixth grade and they're getting, you know, more and more cautious and wary about people looking at them and being critical of them, and by the time they're in junior high school or senior high school, they don't, no, I don't dance. I watch, you know, or whatever. You know, and we begin the process of becoming shut down with our emotions because it doesn't feel safe.
And I don't know how to do that right.
Right, well, right. But that's all, the right only happens if there's somebody watching you to tell you what's right and wrong.
Right.
Because if you're enjoying it, then that's right for you. Mm-hmm. And that means you're in a safe place. We don't know how to find safe places. And I mean safe to express the full range of emotions, not just physically safe. There's a lot of places that are physically safe but are not emotionally safe places. And unless we have more of those safe places, we're going to have people that are shut down and busy trying to shut other people down, not because they're mean, just because if you're being emotional and happy or sad or whatever might be coming up for you, it might bring up my own, and I don't know how to deal with that, so don't. We better not.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. In listening to you, it occurred to me, and this is not a new thought, but it was new for me, that the inner child is not necessarily a beatific always at peace and happy. The inner child is this wellspring of emotions going everywhere, and that's the thing that we shut down.
We shut down, absolutely. Yeah. And as I mentioned before, I took my happy sort of fun kid with me, but the sad, scared, hurt little Peter, I shut down on that. I didn't have any contact with him for quite a long time. I mean, there isn't really a person in there, I know that, but it's for those of us who make a living doing caretaking, where we always take care of other, it's much easier for us to take care of other people often as parents than it is to take care of ourselves. It feels selfish. We've learned that that's selfish if you're taking care of yourself or you're doing something. Mm-hmm. Whereas in fact, as I find, if I take care of myself and I'm in balance and I take some moments during the day to make sure I really do something for myself, I'm in such a better shape to be around kids and other people that I'm not needy. I don't get resentful. If the kids want something, I go, listen, I've been doing nothing but picking up your clothing for you, and I'm snappy when I don't. I take a half an hour, 15 minutes to do something nice for myself. I go home. I'm not in that place.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so that's important. I've been doing a lot of stuff around child abuse and taking a look at that. The latest video I did was one with John Ritter called Wake Up, where it's an hour-long tape about abuse and abduction prevention skills for families, kids, and just some really wonderful information that's a bit more refined than just don't talk to strangers, for instance. Right. We talk about what strangers are, who they are. We talk about saying if you're 8 years old or under, you don't talk to strangers, because when you're 8 years old or under, you can sometimes get into a conversation and forget some of your safety rules about keeping a safe distance and things like that. But if you're over 8, you can talk to strangers, but just, number one, don't give them any personal information, and two, don't let them get too close. So if someone says, what time is it? You got a choice. You can choose not to tell them, or you can say, well, it's almost 8 o'clock or whatever, but just keep, just to be wary, that's all. Mm-hmm. Want to hear my stranger song?
Sure.
If a great big ugly guy walks by while you are playing in your yard and he says, hey, little kid, you want a stick of gum or chocolate bar? Would you take it from him? Well, what if it's your favorite? Well, what if he had ice cream?
It could be hard.
Yeah. Well, we know why, because he's a stranger. Someone we don't know, he's a stranger. He might be nice, but even so, we follow safe advice. So to strangers, we say, if a pretty lady's at your door, she rings your bell, you're home alone, and she says, hey, little kid, please let me in, because I want to use your phone. Would you let her in?
No.
Well, what if she was smiling?
Could be hard.
Well, what if she looked like a movie star?
No.
Well, what if she said she'd been lost for 42 days and she needed a great looking little kid like you to let her in to use her phone right now? Would you do it?
No.
And we know why, because she's a stranger. Someone we don't know, she's a stranger. She might be nice, but even so, we follow safe advice. So to strangers, we say no. Now let me get this straight, to strangers, anyone I don't know, so I shouldn't talk to strangers or go off alone with someone who I don't know, because strangers are not always ugly looking. Sometimes they act nice and friendly, but they're still a stranger. Even if I think I might have seen them, I should never let them get too close. And we know why, because they're a stranger. Someone we don't know, they're a stranger. They might be nice, but even so, we follow safe advice, so to strangers we say no. To strangers we say
no.
To strangers we say no.
You know, I've had a number of musicians on this show over the years, and I haven't ever sung along with anybody. You're almost impossible to keep from doing that. I guess this is a great review, right? You know, the thing I was thinking about that's serious is that so many of the problems that kids get into aren't with strangers, but they're with family members, which are bigger and more difficult problems.
Absolutely.
You're indirectly telling parents how to approach issues like this as you sing and talk to me. How do you talk to parents about approaching issues of family or friends?
Well, that's what it is. 85% of the time abuse happens is with someone that the kid knows and trusts already. And there's a bunch of things. Sometimes there are friends of the family or, you know, coaches or bus drivers, or sometimes it isn't a stranger, it's someone that you see regularly. And what we've done is we've gone to interview people that have been convicted as child abusers. We figured you might as well go there and get some information. What kind of kids do you look for, so we know how to protect kids about this? Hmm. And what they say a lot of times is we look for kids who look like they're victims, who are kind of bowed over. So what we do is we teach them. We have a song, which I'm not going to do, but it's called Strut Your Stuff. It's about standing up tall and looking people in the eye and walking with confidence and looking around you when you walk. Mm-hmm. And if you don't look like a victim, you're much less likely to get picked on by somebody. With other things, like a lot of times stuff will happen. And what we teach parents, for instance, and I do, supposing grandma comes up, or maybe you people out there in television land have, think about this. Did you ever, any time in your life, have someone come up and take you by the cheek with your thumb and your forefinger and go, "Booja, booja, 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 what a cute little kid." Yeah, nobody likes it when that happens. It goes, "Oh, Mom, I hate it when Grandma does that. Would you please tell her to stop?" And what do we tell our children? We go, "Oh, dear, Grandma doesn't mean anything by it. Come on now, she's going to die soon anyway, you know." So, you know, the idea is the adults don't want to deal with this. And we're telling the kids, if you don't like the way an adult's touching you, that's too bad. Your feelings are not important. And what I've been saying is that our feelings are our early warning system. We want our kids to have their feelings intact. So if something feels funny, they can go, this doesn't feel right to me. You know, sometimes kids will climb up on someone's lap and say, "Would you read me a book, Uncle Bob?" And Uncle Bob says, "Sure." You know, and maybe Uncle Bob's not doing anything sexual. Maybe he's just playing with their hair or something. And it's kind of making you feel yucky, you know. Mm-hmm. Cut it out, Uncle Bob. But we don't want to say anything because we asked him if he'd read us the book, and we got up in his lap, and we don't want to embarrass an adult because we're always taught that adults' feelings are more important than our feelings, right? Oh, when we get that message? Yeah. So I figured, hey, we should be able to back up anytime you want. And I said to myself, does that sound like a song title or what? One day hiking in the hills. Do we have to go to a break right now?
Don't stop. This is only to say, with us today on Conversations is Dr. Peter Alsop. He has performed live with such as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Rollo May, Masters and Johnson, Norman Cousins, Buckminster Fuller, John Bradshaw, and Benjamin Spock. This is Conversations on KUAC. I'm Susan McInnes. With us today, Peter Alsop. Please, what you were saying.
What was I saying was that when you start something, you can always back up, like we did with the song. See?
This is very good.
It's important to learn this. Adults need this too, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to hear the song?
I would.
Okay.
One day hiking in the hills, practicing my scouting skills. Whoa, this big snake crossed my track. So I said to myself, "Hey self, get back, back up, back up. You won't crack up if you back up, back up, back up. Give yourself some slack and just get back, back up, back up."
Susan, I'm going to need your help with this, okay? And all the people out there in radio land and TV land, you can sing along with Susan. Every time I say back up, you say back up after me, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, in a tuneful way, exactly.
Sometimes Dad drives much too fast, and I'm afraid that we might crash. So I say, "Dad, now please don't frown. When I'm scared, I gotta speak up, slow down, back up, back up. You won't crack up if you back up, back up, back up. Give yourself some slack and just get back, back up. Back up,
back up."
We'd back up, but you caught it in time, actually.
My Uncle Dave, he sings to me, and sometimes I sit on his knee. But then he starts to pet my hair, and I say, "Would you please stop petting my hair? I'm not a dog or a cat or a fluffy little bunny. Even though I like you very much, I hate it when you do that. Thank you very much for listening." Back up,
back up,
back up. You won't crack up if you back up, back up,
back up.
Back up,
back up.
So if by accident you find you get too close, you can change your mind. Or somebody gets too close to you, just say back up. That's a thing to do. Back up,
back up,
back up,
back up.
If someone's acting all syrupy sweet, they sit so close you can smell their feet. Now moves up to you like a greasy cat. You don't have to act nice when it feels like that. Back up,
back up,
back up,
back up.
You won't crack up if you back up, back up,
back up,
back up,
back up.
I have one verse for teenagers. You want to hear it?
Are there any teenagers out there? I think so.
I think so.
All right.
Once when I was on a date, my date said, it's too hard to wait. I felt that soft tongue in my ear, so I said real loud so we both could hear. Back up,
back up,
back up,
back up.
You won't shack up if you back up, back up,
back up,
back up,
back up.
Give yourself some slack and just get back up. Back up,
back up,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, back up. Thank you.
Yeah.
What did you people think about that? You can applaud out there in your car, with one hand, though, on the wheel.
Peter Alsop with us on Conversations. It's hard being a human being.
No one said it was going to be easy.
Yeah, but we tend to think that it ought to be. If we did it right, as my father would say, if you just held your jaw right, it would be all right.
Sounds like a looking good family.
Yeah.
Ours was, too, in a lot of ways. I think we're in for some major changes in taking a look at being a human being. The world is not in good shape with a lot of the dependency on unrenewable energy sources, with the population growing at the rate that it's growing, with other species being disappearing forever from the face of the planet. People have not realized the immensity of what our human endeavor on the planet is wreaking. And the interdependency of all of these kinds of systems, the hydrology system, the water systems, the food supply stuff, the ozone layer depletion, they haven't realized. They figure, well, we'll go until it's like uncomfortable and then we can fix it. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're in for a rude awakening with some of that. And there needs to be a qualitative change in the way that we operate and some of our motives. For doing things. We are always, so many of us face the looking at what the bottom line is financially and aren't aware because of the way that we've avoided dealing with feelings a lot. We operate in our heads a lot and aren't aware of the importance of having feelings as information to make decisions about how we proceed. A lot of the Native American cultures would, before they make a decision, they would sit and consider what the effect of the decision would have on the seventh generation away from them. Mm-hmm. And we never do that. We're looking very closely, we being our culture, just as like, will it get me lunch this afternoon kind of thing? Or can I put some money to get some more oil for the car or the boat or whatever kind of things I want to do, pay the telephone bills? And, I think that that's something that will get will get balanced in somehow or other, but not without some very painful stuff that a lot of us are going to have to go through.
How do you think that turn is going to happen? As I listen to you, I keep thinking that whether it's a cultural species or as a species in general, our instinct is to shut down when threatened rather than open up. Whether it's a issue of ozone or emotional threat or physical threat, we don't tend to become emotionally vulnerable by choice when that happens.
Right, and that's because of the tools that we've got mm-hmm. in our toolbox when we go out into the world. We learn from our parents by what examples we're given, by what kind of latitude we're given. And a lot of us get sent out into the world with one tool in our toolbox. And you go, okay, wow, here I am, and I'm out on my own finally. Oh, look, here's somebody who wants to have a relationship with me. Well, great, I'll open my toolbox. I've got a tool in you. Want to have a relationship? And you pull out your tool, and it happens to be a hammer.
It's anger.
Or something, sure. Yeah. And we need to pick up some other tools. And some of the tools that, we might get another tool. Someone might say it's important when you're angry, you don't have to be abusive to someone. That can be a tool that somebody never got. Really? Gee, I thought I just could never get angry because I knew that the only time I've seen anger, it's been abusive, and I wasn't going to do that. You mean I can get angry, just say, tell someone when you do that, then I feel angry? Yeah, but that's not going to solve a problem, is it? And one of the other tools you learn is that sometimes just because you don't see the end doesn't mean that the style of operating, I've done things where I've told people that I'm angry, and I never would have done that before unless I could see what the result of that would be before I did it.
Safe.
And yeah, exactly, you've got to feel safe. So, but now I'm finding that what happens is two things happen. One is if I don't express to someone that I'm angry when I'm angry, then I start acting resentfully toward this person. I do little kind of things, you know, little comments I make or things I do. You know, if I'm mad at my wife about something and I'm not bringing it up because I know she doesn't want me to get angry, I know she's going to go through a whole thing, or she won't change anyway, or I can't see the results, right, of expressing that I'm angry, then all of a sudden I do other things like, you know, I notice her window's open and it's going to rain to her car, and I go, well, you know, hey, listen, I let her learn. I told her to shut her windows, you know, those little passive-aggressive things. And I don't feel good about myself when I do those kinds of things. You know, if I can tell her that I'm angry with her about something, you know, without having to tell her what to do to resolve it, it gives her some latitude to try to figure out whether she will. And sometimes, even though I know this person isn't going to respond in any positive way, if I just express my anger, I've been blown away by the fact that by not telling someone what to do and they have a choice, they go, okay, yeah, I suppose I don't have to do that. Or they'll come up and apologize. They might change their behavior toward me in some way and not apologize, but that's okay, you know. And the most important thing is I'm not walking around being resentful. I feel better. So it's a tool to take care of myself that seems antithetical to some of the tools I learned to survive.
Mm-hmm. And the risk may not be life-threatening or whatever that fear is, right?
Right, yeah. So picking up tools is a difficult job because all of a sudden someone will give you a screwdriver, and if all you've ever used is a hammer, you take the screwdriver and you go, and you hit things with it
right.
Until you learn, oh, this is how you use it. It's a different way to use things. And so how do I think the corner's going to get turned? I think it comes from individuals doing their own work. I think we can only help other people around us achieve a level of clarity that we have about ourselves. You know, so you might come and tell me some things you think I should do in my life, but unless you've dealt with some of those things yourself, you're just giving me head information, which is a lot of what we do in schools. We give kids a lot of head information. And a lot of times, if you've gone through something yourself, one of the first things you might do is change the way you give me information. Instead of telling me what I should do or I shouldn't do, which puts me in a place where I might not even be able to accept your information. I might just want to push against the fact that you're telling me I should do something. Because if I do it, it's not mine. It's something you told me I should do. And it needs to be mine if I'm going to integrate it. Does that make sense? So one of the things that you might have learned if you've done some of your work is instead of coming and telling me what I should do, you might just say, you know, Peter, here's something that worked for me when I got into that situation. Wow, all of a sudden now, I don't have to fight against you, or you're not even a factor in it. You just give me some information, I got a choice. I can try and do that too if it sounds reasonable, or I can ignore it. You know, it's a different way of teaching and giving information. And so I think the corner's going to get turned by each of us taking a look at our own baggage, by picking up more tools for ourselves, and trying to relate in a more balanced way with the world around us, saying no to some things. I don't eat meat anymore. And the reason I don't eat meat anymore is I was a vegetarian years ago, and then I went back and I started eating fish again because I wasn't a very conscious vegetarian, you know. I started paying attention to how I felt, and I didn't like the way I felt with a whole pot roast and noodles sitting in my stomach. I kind of felt, I'm heavy, I feel greasy, you know, it tasted good on the way down, but ugh. So I stopped eating meat altogether. But I wasn't taking good care of myself. I wasn't eating, proper beans and rice and stuff like that. So I started eating fish again. And I heard Jacques Cousteau said one point, I've been down there. I do not eat fish anymore. I see what they eat, you know. So, so I said, well, if he's not going to eat fish, I'm not going to eat fish. So I started eating chicken. And then my daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, said, Dad, you know, I don't want to eat any flesh anymore. I'm not going to do it. There's no reason to. There's a lot of reasons not to for health and also for the way that stuff gets... The resources get used up, you know, the way land usage happens. And it takes, nine times more use of grains to feed beef in order to get 1 pound of protein.
Tell me how it is
that making a choice about what you eat makes a choice about the future of the planet for you and for your daughter. How is that connection made?
Well, for me, I don't think that a few less chickens, if I ate the chickens, is going to save the world in any way, or a few more chickens, you know. But for me, it's like when I drive by a woodchuck lying out in the road that's gotten run over, or a skunk or a raccoon, which are fairly, fairly common animals, I have a great sense of sadness that I never wanted to feel before. Instead of just going, oh, another road meat, you know, kind of stuff, I kind of go, you know, I feel awful about the fact that our species is taking away the means for other species to survive on the planet, you know. That we feel like it's up to us to modulate all this and that we can control it and that we can handle it. And yet, there's no place for them to live unless it's in cages, unless it's in zoos where we can come and we go and look at them. And I feel very sad about that. And I don't believe that my not eating meat is going to change that dramatically, but for me, it's a way to remember that I don't want to kill any living animals in order to eat, because I don't need to, you know. And most of us, and I mean most of us, just eat meat, go to McDonald's or Arby's or somewhere like that and get those kinds of things. Instead of people that raise them on the farm, live with them, and are using meat for some part of their diet where they kill their own animals and they clean them and do that, and I actually get in there and see, this doesn't feel good to me to do this. You know, I need to do this to survive, so I'm going to do it. A lot of times if people had the opportunity of doing it, they would stop eating meat too. You know, grains and things like that, we don't have to kill or wipe out. Although what happens is when we get into commerce, we look at that we're getting rid of all sorts of different kinds of strains of rice and other kinds of wheat, because certain things are the only ones that get planted and take up all the space because they hold up the best under kinds of shipping and things that we have to do like that. And what we're doing is we're losing the range in the gene pool. All we need is some kind of a virus or something that hits this particular kind of rice or wheat or corn we have, and all of a sudden we're in trouble because we don't have that protective factor that for millions of years has developed a range of species. And it's the same thing with life in the rainforest and the Amazon that we're losing. And it's just important for us to feel this. And I'm not here to tell people how to behave. I don't tell people not to smoke or drink alcohol. I don't tell people not to eat meat. All I'm saying is if we're going to make choices about our life, what we need to do is be in touch with our feelings, because there's important information that we get about them. And I don't feel good in my feelings. Not that I don't like the taste or the smell of salmon, you know. I think it's great. Or not that there aren't plenty of salmon. But I think nature will take care of that if there's overpopulation in a way that I don't need to be responsible for. And it's not my job to feel like I got to keep the salmon population down, so I'm going to eat some of them, you know. And it isn't, I don't feel particularly close to salmon myself, you know. I mean, it isn't something you want to cuddle with it around a fire or anything like that. It's just that it's. I feel sad at what we're doing, too, and so I don't want to eat flesh.
I hear something else in here, too, and I wonder if it's accurate, that as... I'll blurt and you tell me if this is connected or not. As human beings, we need reminders to stay conscious. And so you choose to do something or not to do something, and because that act will keep you aware of your ethics. Is that...
That's a tool I use, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't say as human beings. I think if human beings are... When we learn to take care of ourselves in ways that include our feelings as the information that we have, mm-hmm. that you don't need reminders because you have your feelings to remind you. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's, as I've mentioned before, has grown up in a culture where we are constantly medicating feelings with work, with paper, with what they call green paper addiction, where worried about money all the time, making money, gambling, shopping, all the kinds of things we do. We're thinking about sexuality and romance, that mental preoccupation that can happen is a great way to keep you out of your feelings. So I don't want to deal with my painful feelings, so I'll just focus on something else. Our culture does that across the board, not to mention the external chemicals that we use, you know, alcohol and other drugs and nicotine and caffeine. I want to be present and experience life fully and have my feelings intact for me, because when I walk into a situation, if something feels uncomfortable, I know right away. Because my feelings are intact, I'm not medicated, and I go, this doesn't feel real good, you know. So I don't need those reminders, really. What I'm explaining, I guess, is that if I sit down to eat meat, I don't feel good about it. I kind of think about what the animals look like and who this individual might have been, and I don't want to eat it. I don't want to support that system. Mm-hmm. And it's the same way with some other things. And I'm maybe more or less comfortable than other people in other areas with some of these kinds of changes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. With us today on Conversations is Dr. Peter Alsop. Is this issue of medication and emotions an issue of kind of shoving the red flags down? When I start to feel uncomfortable about something, I go for the chocolate or the television or a glass of wine or...
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. What goes on when you start having some kind of painful feeling, if you haven't been given any latitude or a safe place to be able to deal with that, then you go, I don't want to deal with this, even before it even comes surfaces, before you're aware of what's going on. And that's what I talked about when I say I think we should be choice makers. If you want to smoke, great. But all I suggest is you take a minute, and before you take your cigarette out and light up and have your nicotine fix, take a minute and say, is there something, some painful feeling trying to come up for me? Maybe I'm feeling negative about myself and the company here, and we're finished eating dinner now, and we're going to start talking, and maybe they'll find out that I'm really not such a nice person as they think I am, or that I've done some things I'm ashamed of, or goodness, or that these things have happened to me. I think I'll just have a cigarette. There, everything's okay. Yeah, now I've got something to do with my hands.
Boy, mostly that, all that stuff doesn't even hit consciousness before you light up, or whatever that is.
And if you didn't light up and you were uncomfortable, it would. And that's part of being human. And some of us are so afraid that if we start feeling some of the sadness, we'll never stop crying. Or if we get angry, we'll just kill a bunch of people. And so we don't even try to find safe places or know how to be able to express some of those things. And that drives a lot of our behavior as adults.
You know, I was remarkably touched watching a videotape of a presentation that you gave to a conference. The videotape is called Open Doors. Opening Doors?
Opening Doors.
Opening Doors, that's right. With some of your songs, people laughed. Nobody sat there. People sang. You sang a song called, is it called Look at the Ceiling?
Mm-hmm.
It's about sexual abuse. And the camera looks down the aisle so you can see past maybe 15 faces, 16, 20 faces. And maybe two-thirds of them were in tears, men and women. My heart went out because nobody touched anybody. And it seemed to me, with all those tears going down the line, all those vulnerable people, it would have been very sweet to reach out and touch a leg or grab a hand. But I was moved that people coming to a conference let themselves just relax those barriers so that whatever compassion or whatever past experience was there for them was able to come out.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because that's one of the things that if you saw somebody leaning over and offering handkerchiefs to the person next to them or giving them a hug or something like that, what do you think would that behavior would be indicating?
There's a caretaking and so maybe not looking at their
own
things.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What a great way to stay out of my own feelings if I can take care of you. There's this person crying over here and I really don't want to feel this stuff anyway. So, yeah, all this poor person, you know, that kind of thing. And it embarrasses both people. It's not necessary. And so I think that's neat that those people were willing to stay with some of the feelings that they were having, you know, during that song. Yeah.
That's a very nice point. Thank you. Yeah. Peter Alsop is with us on Conversations. He's lectured and offered concert performances at more than 400 colleges and universities, has been on the faculty of hundreds of prestigious conferences, and performed extensively, not just in the United States, but in Canada, Southeast Asia, Australia, Central America, and Europe, at, again, conferences, festivals, rallies, and concerts. His music is found on Flying Fish Records. He has his own record company called Moose School Records. And Moose School is your distribution?
It's just a little post office box that we've got. We've got two people that work with me. Can I give a post office box?
Sure. How to me? Peter Alsop, care of?
Box 960 in Topanga, T-O-P-A-N-G-A, California, 90290. 960 Topanga, California, 90290. And there's an 800 number, 800-676-5480. If you want to call us, we'll send you a brochure of all of the kinds of tapes I've got, the videos and the songbooks and all of that stuff, free. So just give us a ring or send us a card. The 800 number again is 800-676-5480. And in Fairbanks, call
1-800. Peter lives in Topanga, California, with his family, actress and director Ellen Geer, and their two daughters, Megan and Willow Geer Alsop. Talk to me a little bit about flexibility. It's something I've heard you talk a lot about in conferences. What's important about flexibility that makes you give it so much time?
I'm not sure that flexibility. What I look at when you're talking about flexibility is really focusing on process rather than results. Mm-hmm. It's the way you get somewhere that seems so important to me. You need a goal to have a direction, but so often people will say, "Well, the bottom line is getting the goal accomplished," and I don't think that's the bottom line at all. I think that how you get there is real important. You know, there was a, do you remember the Weathermen in the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
From Bob Dylan's song, "You Don't Need a Weatherman to Know Which Way the Wind Blows."
Mm-hmm.
It was an underground organization that would break into National Guard Army, steal munitions and things like that. And I met one of these guys who was a weatherman. He's underground, and someone had brought him over to my house. And I was kind of curious about this, and I remember this real distinctly. He was getting an apple out of my refrigerator without asking. And I said, well, what is it you guys do? He says, well, you know, we steal guns and munitions. We're going to kill the pigs and set up a peaceful society. It was real obvious to me there was some part of this missing here somewhere. It was the idea was that if you have a peaceful society, it doesn't make any difference by what means you get there. And it was painfully clear to me that it makes a big difference about how you get there, that if you're going to have a peaceful society, indeed, it needs to be set up through peaceful means. The way that you get there has to be the end in itself. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And
what we do today is tomorrow.
Right. And so often when I see things that we consider lack of flexibility, it's generally because there's somebody that's got an agenda of some sort that they need to get done, and it might not be, I mean, let's look at the word flexibility. What does that mean? It means that willingness to change, if that seems like it's a reasonable thing to do. It doesn't mean you don't have any goals or you don't have any boundaries. It just means I'm willing to be flexible on this, an openness to other ideas and information that's coming in. Doesn't that sound healthy? Yeah, it sounds healthy to me. And sometimes there's people that are driven to just get something finished. And my take on that is that that really has to do with control issues.
Mm.
Has to do with a mental preoccupation. It can be a romance or fantasy addiction kind of a thing, where if I stay in my head because I just want to get there, no matter what happens, whether it's real or not, and whether I'm stepping on people or whether I'm ignoring other information that comes in, does that sound healthy? No, it sounds like I'm driven about something, I'm obsessive about it, or compulsive, and that for me is a red flag right off the bat, that there's probably something I don't want to look at. You know, it's that way when I'm blaming somebody else for something. Mm-hmm. As soon as I find myself blaming someone, my red flag goes up right away. Tool I've learned. I might be right in my assessment that this person is indeed responsible for all the stuff I want to blame them for. However, the fact that I'm even blaming them means I've got some part in this that I don't want to take a look at. And sometimes I have to really search for it because it doesn't come up easily, you know. But generally I can say, yep, I knew this person behaved this way when I entered this interaction with them, and why did I do it? I knew beforehand, and I went ahead and did it, and I didn't want to look at my responsibility. It's easier for me to blame them. They did this again.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have 7-Elevens up here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I call that going into 7-Eleven. Ever imagine a story about somebody going into 7-Eleven and saying, excuse me, I'd like a steak dinner. And the guy at 7-Eleven says, no, man, this is 7-Eleven. We don't have steak dinners. You go, no, you don't understand. I want a steak dinner, please, with some peas on the side, maybe a little mashed potatoes. He said, man, this is 7-Eleven. We got Tic Tac. We got ice cream. You know, we don't have steak dinners. No, you don't understand. I want a steak dinner. There may be some candlelight, little Chablis on the side. Okay. How often do we go someplace into a relationship with somebody and ask them for something that we know they don't have,
mm-hmm.
and then we get all upset with them because they didn't give it to us? You know, and we do that a lot in our relationships. We go into 7-Eleven, and I find myself doing it, and I have to laugh because here I am again. I know this person doesn't have what I want from. Might be my wife, might be my kid, might be my parents. I just know them enough to know they don't have the tools, they don't have what it is I'm looking for, some approval for something I'm doing that I know they're not going to approve of, and yet I really want them to give it to me, and I get mad at them when they don't. That's something that I can do something about. I can stop going into 7-Eleven. I can stop the behavior for a while, but if I want to continue it, why do I go and need their approval? You know,
and then call them a jerk.
And then, or either call them a jerk or blame them, or just be resentful.
Yeah.
Leave the window open to their car. You know. Does that make sense? Sure.
Mm.
Would you like another song?
We have minutes left. Would you favor us with one more?
Let me see. I don't know if I have a short one with minutes, but you could always go out over this thing, huh? Let me see. What do we do?
We could go out over it. We could go long. You know.
I am a pizza.
Could really disrupt people's evening.
I believe you, strangers. I want to try it. I don't know what to do. I am a pizza. Oh, I forgot to tell you.
This is a repeat song.
This is a repeat song.
Okay.
You gonna sing along?
Ready.
I am a pizza.
I am a pizza.
With extra cheese.
With extra cheese.
From tomatoes.
From
Sausage squeezed.
Sausage squeezed.
You're doing great. You know, this is one of, you've got a lozenge in your mouth, and you're worried about the way you sound, and I think it sounds fine. Doesn't she sound fine out there all together?
Yes.
Okay. Garlic and onions.
Garlic and onions.
Oregano.
Oregano.
All together.
I am a pizza, ready to go.
Oh, you know,
didn't know the last part. All right.
Well, there it is. Oh, we could also do, you get a little extra when you watch TV.
Yes, that's
ain't
nice.
That ducky? Well, you're lucky if you see that you get a little extra when you watch TV. Well, you sit too close and you get a big surprise. Lots of radiation in your body and your eyes, and your eardrums hum when someone turns it up too high when you watch TV. Here we go. You get a little extra when you watch TV. Ain't that a ducky? Well, you're lucky if you see that you get a little extra when you watch TV. Now when someone in an advertisement tells me lies, I jump up and switch the channel so I get some exercise. And my body's getting healthy while my mind is getting wise when I watch TV. And daddies only love the mommies when the dirt's all gone from their shirts and shiny floors. The coffee has to be right on. I'm so glad my dad's not fussy, cause he'd leave my mom if we watched TV. Well, you get a little extra when you watch TV. Ain't that ducky? Well, you're lucky if you see that you get a little extra when you watch TV.
Peter Alsop. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What an interesting and fun hour.
Well, good.
Peter just shook hands, folks, with you, and thanks. Well, let me tell you, I haven't said why this man's a doctor yet. I've been calling him doctor the whole time. Later, he's going to tell me why I have a cold. Peter is a PhD in educational psychology. He studied at Trinity College in Connecticut and then at Columbia University Teachers College in New York City. How long ago did you take your show on the road? How long have you been?
First album came out in 1975.
May this career be lifelong. Love to see you in 20 years.
Thanks. Well, who knows? Maybe we'll be here.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.